This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Nathan Sanders.
The Environmental Protection Agency requires municipalities to monitor their water supply for six PFAS compounds. These are regularly called forever chemicals because they don't break down in nature or in the human body. These chemicals have been linked to increased risk of certain cancers, reduced fertility, immune system suppression, and developmental issues for children. The city of Abilene recently notified residents that it had detected levels of PFAS that are higher than the EPA's maximum contaminant levels. Officials are now working on a long-term treatment plan. They're also working to communicate with residents. On the city's website, officials acknowledge that people will have questions and affirm their commitment to providing clear, accurate information. The Director of Water Utilities for the City of Abilene, Matthew Dane, is here to help with that communication. Thank you for being here, Matthew.
Thank you.
So a lot of people are concerned and they have questions. So we want to try to address some of those today. The first question being that a lot of people will wonder how much over the line are the PFAS in Abilene's water, and can you give some context to those numbers?
Sure. So PFAS in general includes quite a few different parameters that we've been measuring in the lead up to this legislation. For several years now, we've anticipated that these would come and so started to do some data collection. And most of those parameters are below the proposed limits as far as what's, in some cases, what's coming in from the raw water, our plants, but especially so in what's leaving the plants. And there's a few parameters in which that's not the case. And so our worst offender, I think it's PFOS, and it's about five or six times over the limit. So if it's four parts per trillion is a limit, I think our highest value is 30. Although the reg, I to my recollection, what's proposed is going to look at annual averages. So that'd be softened some to more around 20, 25 as far as a worst offender of those various species.
Mm. And are there tiers or rankings for how high the levels are, like levels of concern perhaps?
No, they talked about early on a hazard index that would give you some kind of simple way of understanding just how high it is in comparison. I think those are proposed to be dropped. There's a proposed update to the rule that they're going to finalize, or they're closing comments in July 20th. So we're about to, I think, really pin down what the final version of EPA's guidance is going to be. And right now it's just a the big thing is those limits, those maximum contaminant limits, MCLs, for what's allowed to be in the water that we put into the distribution system.
So the EPA began requiring public water systems to monitor for PFAS in 2024. So there's not a long data trail to follow, but have the levels been slowly rising over time, or was it a more sudden increase?
No, for the data that we have, it's just kind of always been there. And that's pretty typical. You know, the forever nature of forever chemicals is they're put out in the environment and they're floating around. A lot of classic sources are some of your firefighting foams, some of the big industries, the big companies you see discussed in the media, the way they develop Teflon and other products. That it's not the Teflon itself, it's really the byproducts of manufacturing that make up some of the PFAS that is harmful. So most of that is, it seems, for the small data window we have, is pretty stable. It doesn't change too much. We're hoping as we ramp up design at the treatment plants, we will get more granular data to understand, are there seasonal shifts? Does it go up and down when it rains and you flush new rainwater in? How does that affect it? So hoping to get more detail in the coming year or two.
You mentioned that there's one PFAS in particular that you've noticed being above normal levels. Does that help you to answer the question of where those chemicals are coming from?
Well, not really. Part of the funding we have in the contract we recently took to City Council is looking at some fate and transport. What I do know is that the one that's high, the highest, I think, is PFOS. And the thing I'm most familiar with that coming from is actually your water-resistant products. So think of your Scotchgard, gets sprayed on carpets and furniture, this water repellent, some clothes have this product in it. That tends to be the major source of the PFOS. And so unlike a firefighting foam or maybe something that is used around aircraft, where you can kind of look at a geographical source for it. I'm not really sure what PFOS offers in terms of our ability to look at its fate in the environment and its source.
And what can be done, if anything?
Well, there's a few basic treatments that we're going to have to deal with. Part of this whole conversation is that the sources themselves are kind of the real fix to the problem. How these are being discharged by the different manufacturers and things needs to be addressed in some fashion. That being said, it's ubiquitous in the environment. Even as far as Antarctica, you find that these PFAS chemicals are showing up. And so part of the remedy is treating drinking water. Ultimately, it's ingestion that seems to be the issue. Exposure to the skin and absorption doesn't appear to be a major pathway to having it reside in your body. And so the technologies that we're looking at primarily are granular activated carbon, which is kind of a industrial version of what a lot of like your fridge filters and Brita filters and things. It's a general absorbent. And the other one is ion exchange, which is kind of a selective media that you can tailor to soak up particular chemicals or whatever it is you're treating for, in this case, the PFAS related. So we're going to be bench testing initially the granular activated carbon and ion exchange based on its success with treatment and the affordability and availability of the technology and ability to manage it.
Okay. And the city has received funding from a national settlement to pay some of this, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we're always watching for opportunities to help fund some of these projects, especially when it's one that there's no optional nature to it. It needs to be done. And in this case, we did get into a settlement with some of these bigger companies who have demonstrated that they have put some of that out into the environment. And so we joined a broader settlement. And from that, we were able to receive $8.7 million of funding. We'll see if that's enough to cover all the cost. My suspicion is we'll be able to use all that for PFAS-related study, design, and treatment construction, and probably still have some more to spend. We'll probably exhaust those funds, but the plan right now is to use them exclusively for PFAS-related efforts.
Can you tell us anything about like a timeline? Are there targets or deadlines that you're looking at?
Yeah, so the currently proposed rule by the EPA says that the normal deadline is 2029. Now, they have allowed for an extension to 2031, but they've put some levers in place that make that particularly cumbersome, including things that could be as much as the utility providing all residents a Brita style or some point of use device that is certified for filtering PFAS. So I think we'll likely find that it makes more sense to try to target the 2029 deadline as closely as we can.
Okay. And the EPA does require ongoing monitoring and reporting to residents. So what is the schedule for that, and when what can residents expect as far as updates are concerned?
Well, our hope is now that this is transitioned into a kind of impending regulation that we will, like I touched on earlier, we'll do a deeper data collection effort and be able to share those publicly. You know, we want to know not just on a quarterly basis as part of UCMR, but, you know, do weather patterns affect those levels and all the rest. And ultimately, we're interested in that probably primarily for any opportunities we get for more cost-effective construction in the process we're building. We need to treat the PFAS. If we can find ways to not overbuild or over-engineer, we definitely look for those opportunities where we can. And more data is what will help us do that.
Finally, this is probably the most important question for residents. Is there a recommendation on how we should use tap water? Should we avoid drinking it? I mean, what concerns should we have?
Sure. Well, I think the key thing to understand is that these limits that have been set are in the parts per trillion. And that seems extremely low. The basis of that is the risk of PFAS is long-term bioaccumulation. So in terms of today, I would say that I know I don't do anything different. I've got my tap water here. It's what I drink all the time. There's the water is safe to drink in regards to that. But I will also say for those who feel more concerned, there are point-of-use devices. I strongly encourage people that if they're interested in using those to find certified PFAS treatment devices, and National Science Foundation, NSF, is kind of the organization who oversees that.
Matthew Dane is the Director of Water Utilities for the City of Abilene. Matthew, thank you so much for coming in to help us answer these questions.
Thank you. Happy to.
The City of Abilene has added information on its website, including a frequently asked questions page. We'll include a link to this on our social media platforms, and we'll continue to check in on the region's water. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Nathan Sanders. This weekend, Americans from Alaska to Florida and Wisconsin to Texas will protest the rapid expansion of AI data centers in the U.S. Humans First is organizing protests in 10 Texas communities, including Abilene. The group Save Abilene is organizing the protest here, and today we have one of the members of that group, who for the purposes of this interview, we will call Steve. Steve, thanks for being here.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
First off, tell us how you got involved in helping to organize this protest.
So I got involved, first of all, standing up to big tech and the data centers. I do a lot of community activism, and honestly, the impacts of Stargate and Oracle and Abilene are just so tangible and visible. I feel like I would be doing a discredit to this community if I didn't do something. I was reached out to by Humans First about the National Days of Protest. In terms of, you know, AI issues and everything like that, we do align on those. I would say, you know, we haven't received too much from them except kind of like a mission statement. But just coinciding with their National Day of Protest, I feel like Abilene needs to be a place where this is happening. And I was kind of hoping their network might be able to reach more of the citizens here.
A lot of people have been pushing back at city council meetings and town hall meetings across the state. Tell us about what your group has done previously to voice concerns about the data centers.
So our biggest thing is we have our website, saveabilene.com, and I think one of the most powerful tools anybody can arm themselves with is information. When it comes to these AI data centers, there's a lot of astroturfing out there. There's a lot of misinformation being spread. And I will say on both sides of the aisle, too, I don't think it's just pro-data center propaganda. I do think there is, to a certain extent, some anti-data center propaganda. And when people don't know these actual facts, figures, what the actual impacts are, it's not going to help the fight at all. You know, when people are saying the data center is going to use 50 quadrillion tons of water and drain the entire lake, well, you know, that's not really helping anything to not know what's actually happening.
So this weekend's protest will be at Cal Young Park.
Yes.
Starting at 10 a.m. Saturday.
Yes.
It's being advertised as a peaceful protest.
100%.
What does your group envision?
So, I mean, honestly, for this first community gathering slash protest, we just want to see who shows up, who's willing to speak out, who's been impacted. Through our website, we've collected a lot of, you know, community voices, people that have been either displaced due to the workers impacted by noise, traffic, and stuff like that. I think the first step to doing anything is just who's willing to say something. I think a lot of people are afraid of, you know, being seen as one way or another because they're willing to protest or get together as a community. But this is not a partisan issue. I don't care who you voted for. I don't care who you're going to vote for. This affects all of us, not just here in Abilene, not just in Texas, but this is a nationwide issue.
Yes, there are a number of concerns that have been expressed over time, from data centers using local resources to noise to increased housing costs, which we have seen, to broader concerns about national security. Is there a key focus of your protest?
So I'll be speaking specifically about the ethical impacts of AI. I mean, we can sit here and talk about the, you know, the environmental impacts and everything like that. But I think what a lot of people gloss over is, who actually wants this technology? I mean, they have a plan. They want to make everybody dependent on these tokens, especially from the enterprise models and stuff like that. Why are we willing to take our town and allow it to be steamrolled by big tech for a technology that nobody's really asking for at the end of the day? I mean, AI surveillance is a huge problem. Literacy rates are already dropping in this country, and putting LLMs in classrooms is not going to help these kids anymore. Content farms are, I hate to use the term, but brain rot for, you know, children, teenagers, and even young adults. IP is being stolen. I make music in my free time, and that's really just horrible when you see artists having their whole catalog scraped and spit back out to them. The mental health ramifications, You know, if you look at what happened at FSU, they're investigating if ChatGPT, I believe, aided with a terrible act being, you know, carried out. Child exploitation material being made, deep fakes. I mean, there is so much stuff in this technology that, like, people don't really think about. So why let Abilene, why let any American community suffer for this technology? Hmm.
So Humans First, which is the nationwide organizer of this weekend's event, say they're not calling for a full stop to all AI, but they want to see an America First approach instead of a big tech first approach. Can you tell us more about that?
So Humans First, so we do agree on a lot of things. I think the technology, we need guardrails in place. It's not even a corporate, it's not even an American issue. You can take some of these language models and trick them into telling you how to make things like IEDs, computer viruses. It doesn't matter who has the technology. The fact is it can get in the hand of bad actors, but you have to ignore reality to act like there's not real potential in this technology, especially in medicine, certain business applications. I don't take this as an anti-technology stance. I take this as a people's first stance.
Right.
You know, if somebody can, you know, the term is AI-induced psychosis. I'm not a big fan of that term. But it's taking people and giving them these complexes and everything like that. And I just think nobody studied this before we put this out into the public. I think we all know somebody that, you know, before they even have a thought now, they need to ChatGPT it.
Well, currently, Texas has 355 data centers with 125 of them in operation, and another 229 are planned for Texas. Governor Abbott has called for legislation to ban AI data centers and repeal tax breaks. Does your group support these steps?
Well, I mean, here's a really simple question. If a business is a profitable business model, why does it need an 85% tax abatement?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this is truly the next level in technology, we shouldn't have to give it all these cuts and everything like that just for them to come into our communities. If you're this 825-acre data center, you know, and you need an 85% tax abatement to operate, then that doesn't seem like a profitable business to me. That seems like you're a business that needs a lot of cuts and a lot of handouts. So I do think we need to pause the development of data centers, at least until the impacts can be studied. You know, if it has to happen, if we do need data centers, I'm sure they can figure out a way to do it safe and reducing the harm to these local communities.
Are there other things you would like to see happen?
Guardrails, 100%. I mean, and like I said, environmental and community impact is huge. But I think having this technology without guardrails in place, it was a horrible misstep. You know, in terms of something Abilene actually can do, if you want to get local. So, I mean, we've all seen the rents go up in town locally. I know somebody whose $2,000 a month rental was turned into a $8,000, $7,000 a month Airbnb. So Abilene's own development code doesn't allow short-term rentals in residential neighborhoods. It doesn't explicitly allow them, as far as I can tell. I'm not a real estate lawyer or anything like that, or a zoning expert. So I've spoken with the city, and the city says it doesn't regulate them. Okay, cool. If they won't enforce their own zoning, then at a minimum, raise the hotel occupancy tax on these operators and actually collect it. I've called the accounting department. They have not reached out to me to see if there's any way to verify if these Airbnbs are paying their hotel occupancy tax. And investors are running these de facto hotels in low-income neighborhoods in Abilene, driving the residents out because a lot of them are renting. And I mean, what landlord's going to, well, I could charge $1,500 a month for this rental or this family, or I could charge $6,000 a month and host AI data center workers. So they either need to enforce the zoning or tax them like the businesses they actually are.
Okay, yeah. So you're here talking to us under a pseudonym, Steve,
yes,
to protect yourself and your family. Why do you think there is such backlash about people that are raising, in your opinion, honest concerns about the AI and the data centers?
I think it's the same thing that happens to anybody that stands up to corporate interest. You know, I mean, they're calling people that stand up to data centers in their backyards domestic terrorists. You know, I mean, it's insane. Like, I'm not funded by China, you know. That's another thing, too. People might think we're terrorists from another country coming to halt the development. No, I just, like, want a safe and practical community, you know, that's not overrun by big tech and this technology. And it's just scary, you know. It really is scary when you're going against these monoliths of slop, I call them.
Finally, so the next legislative session is about 6 months away. There's an election between now and then. What do you want to hear from candidates on this issue?
Well, a lot of them are already speaking out about the community impacts, the environmental impacts, but I do want to hear some of them speaking up about putting guardrails in place on this technology, especially to protect the children, especially to protect the vulnerable population that might be more susceptible to, you know, mental issues and stuff like that. I think that's the first step, is just putting the brakes up and saying, hey, let's see what we need to study before we release this technology back into the wild.
Okay, that's great. Steve is with the group Save Abilene. The protest is scheduled this Saturday at Cal Young Park and begins at 10 a.m. We'll continue covering the many sides of this issue, and the door remains open to the operators of the local data centers to come in as guests on the West Texas Dispatch. Steve, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. For decades, homelessness in Texas has largely been treated as a local problem. Cities operate shelters. Counties run jails and public hospitals. Nonprofits provide housing and services. Police respond to complaints and emergencies. But at the Texas Capitol, state lawmakers are beginning to ask whether that fragmented approach is itself part of the problem. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies has more.
For the next Texas legislative session, lawmakers have been directed to find a way to treat and prevent homelessness. At a recent hearing of the Texas House Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs, lawmakers heard that for some of the most vulnerable people living on the street, local government interventions are expensive and they've become a revolving door. Republican State Representative David Spiller says lawmakers first need to understand the problem that they're trying to solve.
We're really talking about three separate issues, mental health, homelessness, and system of recidivism. They're all related, but they're all separate. To me, to understand what we do to fix the problem, I like to understand what is causing the problem.
The answer lawmakers heard is complicated. People become homeless for many reasons. Some lose a job or can no longer afford rent. These are the economically unsheltered. But witnesses told lawmakers that a smaller and more visible group of people living on the street are suffering from severe mental illnesses, serious addictions, and repeated encounters with police, hospitals, and county jails. Stephen Autry is Director of Operations for Judicial and Correctional Services in Dallas County.
Our taxpayers were spending millions and millions of dollars to house low-level, nonviolent offenders who, for all intents and purposes, were doing life sentences 30 days at a time.
Autry told lawmakers that people are repeatedly arrested for low-level crimes such as criminal trespassing. He said the Dallas County Jail was holding more than 7,000 people with a cost of about $96 per person per day. Autry said more than half of the people were identified as having a suspected behavioral health need.
Communities are not becoming safer. People are not getting better. The same calls keep coming in. The same officers respond and the same offenders return to jail. We cannot arrest ourselves out of this situation.
B.J. Wagner is Executive Vice President for Health and Public Safety at the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. She told lawmakers that an updated analysis found local governments are spending about $3.2 billion a year responding to roughly 18,500 high-needs people who are also at high risk of becoming involved with the criminal justice system.
This comes out to an average of $175,000 per person per year.
A person in crisis may interact with police, EMS, a hospital, a homeless services agency, and a county jail. But those systems may not have a complete picture of what the others have already tried. Wagner says one solution begins with the first 911 call. She described programs that train dispatchers to better identify behavioral health crises and send the right response.
That's important because right now, 95% of those calls are miscoded, misidentified, and misdeployed. As a result, they receive the wrong resource, the wrong response, and often the wrong outcome.
Wagner says sending the right team the first time reduces violence and delivers better outcomes. Possible solutions discussed at the hearing included crisis stabilization centers, mental health diversion programs, substance use treatment, intensive case management, better coordination after people leave jail, and more sharing of data among police, hospitals, EMS, and homelessness programs. But lawmakers also said Texas needs to intervene earlier. Democratic State Representative Cassandra Garcia Hernandez said addressing people who are already homeless is only part of the challenge.
That's obviously what we would want to address, people who are currently homeless right now, but where do we stop people from becoming homeless is just as important.
Lawmakers heard that the state is already spending a lot of money to address the problem of homelessness, but much of the money is being used to support the revolving door of law enforcement, ER treatment, and jail stays, and then putting the unhoused back on the street, without providing support for stabilizing and drug treatment of the unhoused who are in crisis. I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
The White House on Buffalo Gap Road has sparked curiosity across Abilene for many years. The church that owns the property says its vision for the landmark is still alive. KACU's Allison McCall has the story.
For many years, a grand white mansion with tall pillars has captured the eye and curiosity of passersby on Buffalo Gap Road. Locals call it the White House, and it's become one of Abilene's most recognizable residential landmarks. Few people have ever stepped inside. Kelsey Holson is a realtor with Sendero Properties. She says the mansion stands out not only because of its size, but because of its location.
Generally, a house of that size, somebody that can afford that, typically, I would think, wants privacy or lives in a neighborhood that's gated. So it's just kind of interesting how it's built right there on one of our major roads. And, you know, thousands of cars pass it every week. And everybody notices it. It's hard not to because of its size, but then also its style and its grandeur.
That fascination has lasted for decades. Right now, the property sits empty, and that sparks a lot of speculation. Earlier this month, a Facebook post about the mansion drew hundreds of comments from people sharing memories, asking questions, and imagining what the property could become. The mansion's story starts with Peter Casimirs, the businessman who built it in the 1980s. According to Reporter News Archives, Peter Casimirs immigrated to North America after World War II. After finding success in business in Abilene and opening the Royal Inn, he and his wife, Patricia, began building the mansion in 1983. Art Hall, the builder, was hired to complete the project. He says the Casimirs wanted the mansion to be something the community could enjoy.
I think they wanted to give to Abilene what they thought was good. That was the purpose of the intention that Peter and his wife had, was to share something classy with the folks of Abilene.
Construction also came during a difficult period for the local economy. Hall says the oil downturn of the 1980s left many skilled workers without jobs, making the mansion an unexpected source of employment.
It was a godsend to me and to a number of people that I hired. Many carpenters would come to me and they were just absolutely thrilled to have a job at that point in time, because it was a tough time back in the 80s and a lot of businesses in Abilene were having to close their doors.
The mansion was unlike anything Hall had worked on before. He says it featured imported marble from Mexico, chandeliers from Germany, 7 fireplaces, 2 swimming pools, and 9 guest bedrooms, each with its own private bathroom. One of the biggest challenges was installing trim in the home's curved rooms. Workers even had to soak some of the wood in water so it could bend into place. At one point, Hall says as many as 75 people were working on the project. Upon completion, the Casimirs lived in the house briefly, Hall says just for a few months. In 1990, the mansion story took a different direction. The property went into foreclosure, and the mansion sat vacant for several years. After the Casimirs lost the property, it changed hands multiple times before a group from California purchased the home with the plans to refurbish it. Art Hall says those plans also never came to fruition. In 2009, Champions Church purchased the mansion. Preston Humphreys is the pastor of the church.
It did come into the church's possession some years back as the church was acquiring some of the surrounding property with vision to use it as a permanent church home. That vision still remains today.
For Champions Church, restoring the mansion is a long-term project.
My hopes are that it becomes something very fruitful in Abilene. The facility as it sits now testifies of everything that can go wrong. And I would like to turn that story around, where it ends up becoming a landmark, not of dysfunction or mismanagement, but becomes a landmark of productivity.
Pastor Humphrey says the church still plans to transform the mansion into its permanent home. The process, he says, will take time as the building is renovated to meet commercial code and the church works to complete the project without debt. Until then, the White House will continue to be a topic of conversation and curiosity for its neighbors in Southwest Abilene. I'm Allison McCall in Abilene.
It's time for West Texas Roots. Today is a 3-in-1. Rodney Dewis and his career, Judith Allen and her fishing tradition, and Stephen Abbott on getting a deer on the last day of open season.
Still be careful what you wish for. Several years ago when I was younger, I'd been deer hunting. Watched all season, didn't see a deer that I wanted to shoot and all, and it got to the last day and I thought, well, I'm going to shoot one. So I always come to this feeder. The last day, none of them showed up. Sad, loaded everything in the truck and I was driving down the road. People with me and I turned and I said, man, I really wish I'd have had a deer, and about that time one jumped right in front of the middle of the truck. Bam. So I got my deer. Hours of calling the sheriff, cleaning it up, I got a deer.
I remember as a child, just our family would always go fishing, and it was a great story. And I remember one time my dad, he always took the fish off my thing. And one time I thought, I'm just going to throw this out without, and I pulled up a perch. But it was the best day of my life just to catch a fish. And I just remember all those Saturdays at the fishing hole. When I was a kid, it was Fort Fannin, but it was Kirby Lake. Back in the day, that was a great lake. And then that little park off of South 11th Street, it used to be grown up. My granny used to take us down there. She would catch turtles all the time. My husband, we did it a few years ago on Easter Sunday. I did my communion in my room, and we went, and he couldn't sit down because I caught five.
No, she caught three fish that were 47 and a half pounds.
It was
out
five.
Of three fish. Anyway, it might have been five, but I knew it was almost 50 pounds of fish. I didn't catch nothing that day because she kept me running up and down the bank putting them in the freezer.
I think people just need to do that more with their kids. Get them outdoors, off of the computers. And that's what we do with him. We try to get him outdoors.
I grew up southwest of here in Coleman County, raised on a small family farm. Got to where farming cotton, milo, and wheat wasn't economical anymore. We went, moved off, went to college, went to Tarleton over at Stephenville. Got a degree in general ag, and then when graduated the first time, USDA had a hiring freeze on, so worked on a master's in teaching, and then when I graduated that time, they sent me to the Panhandle. Did about 18 years at the Panhandle, and then did the last 18 years down here in Central Texas. Started out, it was a soil conservation service, and then it changed to the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Helped a lot of producers, in conserving their soil. Just a boring 36-year career. I guess after I graduated from college, moved off, Dad put the land in CRP, basically planted it to grass, and we're currently, this is going to be 2 years this September, come back to the family farm, and now we do the grass and the cows, and last year we put the fences in, this year we're putting the water in so we can, rotate it and maintain the grass. No more farming. Well, when you get married and you start having kids, that kind of you gotta make sure you got something to take care of them. Don't farm because you can't make a living at it.
We recorded these stories at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. From homemade crafts to original business ideas, more than 100 young entrepreneurs took center stage this past weekend at the Children's Business Fair in the Mall of Abilene. The Abilene Chamber of Commerce partnered with Abilene Teachers Federal Credit Union to give children the opportunity to experience what it's like to own and operate a business. KSU's Allison Diaz has more.
Here's your keychains.
Smaller sizes.
2 for $5.
This past Saturday, the Mall of Abilene shifted the commerce from the stores to the corridors as young entrepreneurs worked to attract shoppers to their displays. Each young vendor at the Abilene Children's Business Fair showcased their creations while parents supported them and customers purchased handmade goods.
What's the difference?
And it's not just a chance for kids to earn a few extra dollars. Elizabeth Gray, Community Development Officer for the Abilene Teachers Federal Credit Union, says the children learn financial responsibility through firsthand experience.
We have kids' accounts, and we're always trying to teach financial education, IT classes in the schools, and for adults as well. But starting kids out knowing about money and how to manage it is a big deal. They have to price their items. It just helps them learn the value of money and knowing, like, okay, well, it cost me this much to make this product, and I made $2 from it or $10. So it's just really cool to see their creativity.
And parents say the biggest impact they see is in the confidence of their children. Jessica Rubio helped her daughter Emma start a baking business. Rubio says the real treat for her has been watching Emma shine.
I love it. Her confidence has grown tremendously. She has created a bunch of different flavors, as you can see. So I'm just monitoring and just, of course, buying everything for her. Supporting the cause, but other than that, I mean, I love it. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
While Emma has enjoyed baking since she was very young, she admits the idea of starting a business was a little scary.
Well, we just started this year, but I've been baking for a while, so we just started off, like, I've been really kind of nervous to do this, and once we come out here, we've had a bunch of customers already. I just kind of opened up and just been confident now.
Emma also enjoyed getting to be creative, coming up with unique flavors for her baked goods.
So this is Cosmic Brownie ones, and this is a Mazapan Mexican candy one. These are like churro ones, these are lemon ones, these are Oreo ones, and these are chocolate-covered pretzels, chocolate-covered Rice Krispie Treats, and chocolate-covered Oreos. I don't know, it just kind of comes to mind and just wants to bring out interesting new things that people never really do.
Confidence looked different for every young entrepreneur. For some, it meant learning from failure. Jaden Priest, owner of the crochet company The Plush Portal, shares that although he is a veteran to the fair, he hasn't always sold crochet chickens.
I started right after this craft show last year, actually, because I did a lemonade stand here last year. It did not go so well, but I saw that a lot of the crocheters were doing well, so I decided to try that, and it went really well. So,
this year, Jaden's booth exclusively featured plush chickens of various sizes, including a huge Titan chicken, which took 5 hours of work. He says that deciding on crocheting chickens came about by complete happenstance.
So, at school one day, just a kid caught on to the fact that I could crochet, so he asked me if I could crochet him a chicken, and I did, and so it turned out to be really fun and fast, and so now that's just all chickens.
Yeah. My brother will be the cashier for you today.
No.
The plush portal wasn't the only business that found its inspiration at school. Moses Lux learned how to create beaded keychains at his school. He fell in love with the activity and eventually decided to start his business, M&E Lux Keychains.
Mom got us this box that had a starter kit for beaded keychains. It had a manual on how to do some stuff. I only learned flowers and those smaller beaded keychains from it.
Standing close by, Moses and Elijah's mom, Natasha Lux, smiled with pride while describing how running this small business has benefited her sons.
I'm loving watching their confidence grow. I'm loving watching their self-esteem, as I said, and their confidence, but also their life skills of dealing with customers and also learning about how to manage money and how to give change and take money and things like that. So they're learning a lot of life skills through this.
While some of the young entrepreneurs were motivated by the bottom line, others started with a desire to solve a problem. Addison Harbin launched her business, Gloss & Glow Nail Company, after she found that designing and wearing press-ons helped her stop biting her nails.
So my inspiration is, like, I bite my nails really bad, and these kind of help me not do it as much, and it kind of just, like, calms my senses for me, and I think it just can help other people. Like, it helps me, too.
Event manager Elisa Goldsmith with the Chamber of Commerce says that her favorite part of the event is getting to watch the kids reach for their goals.
Seeing the smiles on all these kiddos' faces, they have a dream. Seeing the kids have a vision, have their families help them bring it to life is just so rewarding.
The Children's Business Fair may have been designed to teach kids about financial responsibility, but these young entrepreneurs also built confidence, resilience, and creativity. From overcoming nerves to bouncing back from failure and turning hobbies into businesses, the kids are coming away with many lessons that can help them for years to come. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, let them know they can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Calvin Claiborne is our digital editor. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm Nathan Sanders.